This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 3rd. From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, I'm Yuko Kodama. In today's program, the U.S. Senate fails again to pass a measure on troop deployment to Iraq. Families of victims in the Utah Crandall Canyon mine disaster testify before Congress. As Senegal threatens to remove peacekeeping forces from Darfur, the U.S. Senate debates divestment from the region. And environmental groups campaign for coal industry financiers to invest in renewable energy. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. President Bush today made good on his promise to veto popular legislation that would have increased health care coverage for low-income children. The measure would have raised millions of dollars of funding for the state Children's Health Insurance Program, or SCHIP, by increasing taxes on cigarettes. The SCHIP bill would have expanded the program to include an additional 4 million uninsured children. The legislation passed the Senate last week by a veto-proof margin, but is 15 votes shy of a veto override in the House of Representatives. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today that supporters of the bill will work on securing the votes needed to override the presidential veto.
I think that the president will find himself isolated on it. Whether we override or not, we will continue to send legislation to the president's desk that will ensure these children. I don't think the president wants to say to the American people that he, as the decider, self-proclaimed decider, wants to decide which child in America has health care and which child does not.
Bush opposed the funding increase for SCHIP, calling it one step closer to socialized medicine. Arrests and manhunts continue days after the Burmese military junta announced that the situation on the streets had returned to normal. Ronald Ong Yang reports from Chiang Mai, Thailand.
Even with internet communications down, news continue to come out of Burma every day about nighttime raids and mass arrests of Buddhist monks, members of opposition National League for Democracy Party, and others linked to last month's protests. Eyewitness reports from Rangoon say that many of the city's monasteries are empty or surrounded by soldiers. Tate Nai is the secretary of the Assistant Association for Political Prisoners, an organization that has worked for more than 10 years to keep track of prison conditions and political arrests.
The number on the list of confirmed arrests that we have so far is 379. The number of monks arrested in monastery raids is more than 1,000.
Nai says the actual number of detainees is much higher than what his organization can confirm. Meanwhile, the European Union today voted to extend sanctions against Burma. UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari concluded a four-day visit to Burma yesterday and is expected to address the UN Security Council by the end of this week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ronald Aunine in Chiang Mai.
North Korea has agreed to disable its nuclear reactor at its Yongbyon facility by the end of this year. The deal is the result of six-party talks between the two Koreas, the U.S., China, Japan, and Russia, in exchange for disabling the reactor and declaring all nuclear activities. North Korea will receive 1 million tons of heavy fuel oil and may be removed from the U.S. list of countries that sponsor terrorism. The security situation in the Somali capital of Mogadishu remains highly unstable, with almost daily fighting between Ethiopian troops and urban insurgents. Abdurrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
A huge fire broke out early Tuesday evening in Somalia's main Bakara market, killing one person and injuring two others. Traders at the market say a mortar shell fired by Ethiopian troops started the blaze. Large columns of smoke could be seen blowing from the market, and the sky was lit up through the night by the huge inferno which raged into the early hours of Wednesday morning. After 15 years without a central government, Somalia still lacks an effective firefighting force. First clashes between Islamist insurgents and Ethiopian troops were raging near the market before the fire started, but the Somali government has denied this. Ethiopian troops have been in Somalia since they crossed into the country early this year to help the then weak transitional federal government drive out an Islamist movement. that have been in control of much of southern and central Somalia. Near daily attacks by Islamist insurgents have been targeting Somali government forces and foreign troops since the government announced the end of major combat operations in late April. The insurgents have since been waging an Iraqi-style guerrilla war. For FSRN, I am Abdulrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
The state of Texas has halted an execution scheduled for today. The state's Criminal Court of Appeals has asked the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to rule on whether the three-drug chemical cocktail used in lethal injections violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to examine the constitutionality of lethal injections during its current term. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The Senate has failed to pass an Iraq redeployment measure again. In the House, lawmakers passed a plan where President Bush would need to provide Congress with a strategy for troop withdrawal. Bush, however, would not be required to follow that plan. Frustrated Democrats are proposing various Iraq measures, but few are gaining majority traction. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
With little fanfare, little notice, and less than 2 hours of debate, the Senate took up the most extensive Iraq withdrawal measure out there by Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin. It would demand that funds be cut for all combat troops not redeployed by June. It failed. It received 28 votes, the same number as it did last week. Senator Feingold on the Senate floor tells why he is introducing it again, just days after its last failure.
As long as our troops are fighting and dying for a war that doesn't make sense, as long as the American people are calling out for an end to this tragedy, as long as the administration and its supporters press ahead with their misguided strategy, we have a responsibility to debate and vote on this issue again and again and again.
This measure is likely to be the only Iraq withdrawal-related measure on the $460 billion defense funding bill the Senate is debating. Meanwhile, in the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi seems to be shifting her strategy from forcing redeployment timelines to one that supports more mild measures, hoping to gain broad consensus. In one such instance, the House overwhelmingly passed a measure Tuesday that requires President Bush to submit a plan for a troop withdrawal. He doesn't have to follow that plan, though. Former member of Congress and current director of Win Without War Coalition Tom Andrews says this incremental approach could be dangerous for Democrats.
People are frustrated out across the country. They want to see this war come to an end, and they want to see Congress act. And if their member of Congress gets some votes that allows him or her to give the appearance of taking action, voting for measures that appear to make progress or appear to confront the president, when they have the practical effect of doing little or nothing, then what you've done is you've taken away the single most important thing that we have at our disposal to try to end this war, and that's pressure from people across this country.
Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat of California and chair of the Out of Iraq Caucus, speaks about the challenges the progressives are facing when pushing for a withdrawal date.
We should continue to develop legislation or reintroduce legislation with a date for withdrawal. This is our preference. We know that they cannot get support for that on the Senate side. And we know that our leadership is not willing to continue to come up with legislation that does not have the support.
Some of that frustration with Democratic leadership's craving for consensus has shown itself in a highly controversial proposal by three influential members of Congress. It's a tax increase to pay for the war that is currently being paid for through loans. Appropriations Committee member James McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts.
Whether you're for or against the war, I would like to think you don't want to dump the costs on our kids. As I said, I think this the war in Iraq is this generation's mistake. I don't want it to be the next generation's burden. And I think it will help kind of focus our attention on the fact that there are real costs involved here. And then the sacrifice is not just, it needs to be just not on the backs of those people who have sent over into harm's way.
The politically risky war tax is unlikely to gain any support. The Republicans shot back, framing the Democrats as the party of taxes. But the most important opponent is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I put the surtax in the category of the draft. Of course, you cannot conduct the war without shared sacrifice and the support of the American people. It is clear by the reaction to the draft and to any tax that shared sacrifice is not there. The president has not called for it. And so I don't support a draft, and I don't support a surtax, and I don't support the war.
Meanwhile, the House plans to take up two other mild Iraq policies later this week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Last weekend, 20 African Union soldiers were killed or injured in Darfur. It was one of the deadliest attacks since they deployed in Darfur 3 years ago. The attack demonstrated the vulnerability of a small and reportedly ill-equipped group. The concern is that if AU forces have trouble protecting their own troops, they will likely have difficulty protecting the 2 million displaced people living in camps and hiding in the bush in Darfur. Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade has threatened to pull out troops if an investigation determines that the Senegalese are killed because they lack equipment. Jaga Sek files this report from Senegal.
20 African Union soldiers were killed or injured and 9 reported missing on Saturday night after an assault led by armed men on the Askanita base in Darfur. According to the AU, the assailant, who arrived on 30 vehicles, looted and destroyed the base. Among those killed was one Senegalese soldier. Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade declared on Monday he would pull his country's troops out of Darfur if it was determined African peacekeepers were killed at the weekend because they were not equipped to defend themselves.
I can send troops, but I'm not going to send people to be slaughtered. So I threatened to pull out troops, and I wasn't alone. Rwanda said the same thing then. Rwanda has many soldiers there. This time, another Senegalese soldier died. I'll order an investigation into the attack to see if they were armed, if there was an ambush. And if they died because they didn't have the arms to defend themselves, I will withdraw all of the Senegalese.
The African Union peacekeeping force was deployed in 2004 to monitor a ceasefire between the rebel groups seeking greater autonomy for Darfur and the Arab-dominated central government. Senegal has one of the largest contingents, with 550 men in Darfur, and has taken casualties in the past. So, the question is whether Senegalese president will enforce his threats to pull out troops. Last April, 3 truckloads of Senegalese peacekeepers who were on their way to guard a water source were ambushed and 4 among them killed. Last weekend attack, which is being blamed on rebel factions, was the worst single attack on AU forces since the 7,000-strong mission was deployed to Western Sudan. Former head of Senegalese army, General Mamadou Mansour Seck, says the deployed AU forces need to be better equipped.
Senegal was not particularly targeted. There are countries like Rwanda, Uganda, or Nigeria that have many people there. There's no political reason behind this attack, but the cause of these attacks is that these troops have become vulnerable and that there is no logistics, salaries are paid late, mobility and aerial coverage are lacking, etc. That's why the Sudanese government prefers AU troops to UN troops that are generally better equipped with better logistics.
The AU has long complained of a lack of equipment in Darfur, including attack helicopters and rapid response vehicles. They have also said their force was too small to contain the conflict in the vast and arid region the size of France. A UN resolution accepted a 26,000-strong UN mission due to be deployed by 31st December. The Security Council resolution grants the peacekeeping mission authority to use military force to protect its personnel, guarantee the safe travel of aid workers, and provide protection for civilians. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Jaga Sek.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate this morning heard testimony on proposals to end the genocide in Darfur. One method put forth by lawmakers is corporate and institutional divestment from Sudan. Senator Richard Durbin from Illinois says we should not believe that the killing and suffering in Darfur have ended.
Time and again, this government has come forward and said, we're going to change this situation. We're going to put an end to it. And they have failed utterly to do so. We have to accept our own personal responsibility here. And the question is, what is our responsibility? In this era of asymmetric challenges to great powers, we have to look to the tools that are available to put pressure for change. What Senator Brownback and I bring to you is one tool that could be used, a tool that will combine a lot of different elements in putting pressure on Sudan to make a change, and more importantly, pressure on Sudan to engage in a peace conference that will bring ultimate peace to this region. I don't believe the presence of peacekeeping troops will be an easy task so long as the militias run roughshod over these poor people. If we can force the government of Khartoum to move toward real peace conference and real accommodation, then we might find real peace for these poor people who have suffered for so long.
A bill put forward by Senator Durbin from Illinois and Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas has a number of divestment protocols that include the creation and maintenance of a list of companies supporting the Sudanese regime, a government report on the impacts thus far of current economic sanctions, and the further prohibition of the federal government from contracting with companies that support the regime. In the past 2 years, 121 miners have died while working in U.S. mines. Today, family members of those who died at the recent Crandall Canyon mine disaster in Utah testified before Congress. They spoke about how the tragedy has affected them and what the government needs to do to protect miners and their families in the future. Karen Miller has more from Washington, D.C.
Cesar Sanchez is a brother of Manuel Sanchez, one of six miners and three rescue workers who in August died at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. Sanchez says that more needs to be done to protect miners and their families.
Someone needed to look after our interests before the collapse, which would have prevented it, and after that collapse, to assure everything possible was being done to rescue.
In this year alone, 25 miners have died in coal mines across the United States. At the hearing today, family members said they were kept in the dark by mining companies trying to protect their own interest. Michael Morasco is the son-in-law of Carrie Alred, who was killed in the Utah mining disaster.
They just told us what we wanted to hear and not the facts. All we heard was earthquake, earthquake. We did not want to hear about earthquakes, but wanted to know when we were going to see our loved ones again. For the families that are Hispanic, there was no translator for the first 2 days, so it was extremely upsetting for them. Questions were asked, and the responses were always, that question has already been asked, or we are looking into it.
George Miller, Democrat from California, chairs the House Committee on Education and Labor, which sponsored the hearing. He says all those involved should know the truth.
The families of the miners who died, the miners who continue to work underground, and the communities in which they live deserve to know the straight facts.
Back in 2006, Congress passed the most sweeping mine safety legislation in more than 30 years called the Miners Act. The act called for updated safety and technology standards in order to prevent future accidents. For many involved in the Utah disaster, however, the legislation is not enough. Wendy Black's husband was one of the rescuers who died in the Utah mining accident. She testified that even before the rescue attempt that killed him, her husband Dale had tried to leave a dangerous spot in the mine before he was told to keep pushing ahead.
Dale was trying to have his miner operator pull back when shift foreman Jesse Gordon came up and asked Dale, "What are you doing?" Dale said he told him it was too risky and he was pulling out. Gordon told Dale, "You can't leave all that coal."
She says even to this day, she has many unanswered questions.
Who was in charge of it at the time of the rescue? Who approved of this mining plan, and who was to oversee this plan and that it was being followed correctly? And who in their right mind would send rescuers underground while the mine was still bouncing? I would like to know how a K order, which is an imminent danger or a closure order, be modified 15 times as they proceed into the mine.
Sheila Phillips says whatever legislation is passed, it still won't bring her son back.
It's just hard to have hope and have your heart broke every day. And to watch your son, your grandson, grow up without a dad. I just miss him, and I want him to, I don't know. I would like to know where my son is in that hole so I can leave a marker on the map.
The committee says the Department of Labor has yet to comply with repeated requests for information about the Utah mining accident, but they will continue their investigation. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The United Nations Refugee Agency has launched a campaign to raise $220 million by 2010. This money would allow 9 million refugee and vulnerable children, particularly those from Sudan's Darfur region, Iraq, and Colombia, to receive an education. As Simba Rousseau reports from Beirut, many refugee children of Iraq suffer major gaps in their education due to displacement.
Ali and his five brothers have been in Lebanon for 2 years. His family fled Baghdad for Lebanon after their lives were threatened.
The conditions were very bad. The crimes, they would slaughter people in front of our eyes.
Residing in a mainly Shia suburb of Beirut, he is one of the few Iraqi children with access to education.
We are learning reading, writing, and how to use a computer here in Lebanon.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees estimates there are currently over 540,000 extra children of school age dispersed across the Arab region. Some of the estimated 40,000 Iraqis in Lebanon have been here for several years, while others arrived after 2003. Lebanon is not a signatory to the convention relating to the status of refugees and lacks any legal framework. Access is limited in Lebanon's overcrowded public schools, and private schools are too expensive for most refugees. Those already enrolled in schools face the risk of dropout due to differences in curriculum and foreign language requirements. Robert Beer is the education project coordinator for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Lebanon.
There were big gaps in the provision of assistance to Iraqi refugees living in Lebanon, particularly inside of the field of education. And the education was a big cost for families.
Beer says that of the 300 families NRC surveyed in Lebanon, over 30% of Iraqi kids have spent an average of 3 years outside of schools. More than half of the Iraqi households said financial constraints kept them from sending their children to school. In response, the Norwegian Refugee Council opened an education resource center to support the Iraqi refugee community in providing intensive learning to Iraqi children. One element of the assessment is providing mental health services and treatment. Again, Robert Beer.
And what we do is we academically test children through the center, so they come in for half a day's academic assessment. And there's some behavioral assessment at the same time. And then we create an individual file upon each child. And then the idea is that we then tailor an academic program to filling in the gaps in their education so that they are enabled, therefore, to perform in a mainstream Lebanese schools.
Since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, more than 12% of the refugees that have fled to Lebanon say they were kidnapped, threatened, or experienced traumatic events. Rose is 13 years old. She came to Lebanon 7 months ago after fleeing Iraq with her family by car to Syria.
My sister became the ambassador for Iraqi children. She started to travel to other countries. When she went to Saudi Arabia and came back to Iraq, she was kidnapped. They called my father to demand money. So my father paid the money and then we left Iraq.
Charles Nasrallah is the director of INSAN. He says that most Iraqi children experience racism in Lebanon and that it is vital to create a daily structure and routine in a safe environment.
Iraqi children have faced problems because of the Iraqi violence. Here in Lebanon, they are also facing problems of not being welcomed.
According to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, there are over 400 Iraqis detained in Lebanon, mainly for illegal entry or illegal stay. Those who arrive in Lebanon legally are refused visa renewals. Among the countries in the region, Lebanon has the highest number of detained refugees and asylum seekers. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Beirut, this is Simba Russo.
And now from Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The death of the pursuit of a dream, a house. The letter came from someone who I didn't know. It was short, to the point, and shocking. A young wife and mother was at her wit's end because she was about to lose her family's beloved home. It surprised me and stunned me. I've been reading about the problem in several papers, but here it was. The prospect filled this young woman with dread and terror. I wondered how many others were joining her in this journey into possible homelessness, and my research uncovered a rising number all across the nation, from San Francisco to Brooklyn, from Philadelphia to Buffalo. In cities on both coasts and in places in between, we're seeing the loss of homes by working families, many of whom have been duped into acquiring not homes, but the subprime loans that made home buying possible. Many of these loans were made with what's called adjustable rate mortgages, or ARMs. ARMs suckered poor folks to buy into them with teaser rates meant to attract them, but as the antonym suggests, the rates get adjusted, and almost always upwards. Before long, people began paying 50% more than they paid 6 months earlier, only to be outpriced, and then, boom, a few missed mortgage payments, and foreclosure is sure to follow. With this financial sleight of hand, people are tossed out of their homes, and the properties, they're just flipped again, again, and again. For bankers, builders, and speculators, it was the next best thing to free money. It was great. Well, it was great for everybody except working folks, who often lost homes that they've dreamed of owning. If the corporate media is to be believed, average people were simply too stupid to know that they couldn't afford to buy a house. But that was the very foundation of the subprime lending industry. Several years ago, I remember ads in the black press advising folks of the ease with which to buy a house these days. Few people took into account how ARMs actually worked. In the last 6 months, over 50 subprime lending companies have gone out of business. One of the biggest, New Century Financial, filed for bankruptcy protection in April 2007. But having made their mint, their bankruptcies ain't like yours, if you can get them, that is, after the U.S. Congress made it harder. New Century sold their stock before the shortfall, netting over $40 million in profits. So owners have one fate. Working folks with few assets have another. Once again, a capitalist bubble has burst, with one bunch taking the goodies and the other taking the proverbial hole in the center of the donut. Nothing. I thought of that woman's pain, her feelings of loss, dread, and horror, magnified over tens of thousands and then millions of people. We begin to see the scope of this problem that threatens to scuttle the hopes and dreams of at least a generation. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Monica Lopez and Tyra Giese produced today's broadcast. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website at www.fsrn.org. From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, I'm Yuko Kodama.